There's the snap, handoff to Hunter. He's going off right side, and Flowers tries to dive for him at the end zone. He's in for a touchdown.
Now, back to Cofield and Company, live at the Thomas and Mack.
Yep, lots of UNLV running Rebel Talk coming up. 7 o'clock start. You can get your tickets at unlvtickets.com. Come on down here. Regular season opener against a pretty solid program that's had five straight winning seasons, former opponent of T.J. Otzelberger in the Summit. Let's talk a little UNLV football as we do every Tuesday with Caleb Herring. It's brought to you by Insperity for employee benefits and full-service HR support. Visit Insperity.com. Caleb, how do you come up with an explanation for the way the Rebels started the game against Colorado State? It could not have been the early start, right?
No, I think maybe what would be the first excuse, but there's no real explanation for that. I talked about it a few times before that even during the game, where understanding the situation, anybody around the program, within the program, understood that the team goal, if nothing else, not let's not even talk about Sanchez's job first, but like as a player, the team goal of getting to six wins was still out there. As hard as that is to believe going into last week's game, but you had to win every game. So there should be no excuse to come out with flat-footed or unenthusiastically and low energy and allow the opening kickoff to go back to the house. And that, like I said, an absolute disaster of a start. And then, you know, the defense that we had been talking about that had been playing well against San Diego State and even other games throughout the season, that a much improved defense for UNLV. We had talked about them in, you know, the days leading up to last week's game, and for them to then come out after that kickoff and on their opening possession, their opening defensive chance, give up a pretty easy, fairly easy drive to Colorado State to go down 14-0 very early in that game. I think there's nothing you could say to really explain that. You can make excuses if you want to, you know, you say the day game start was maybe a little different, the mountain time change and the quick turnaround for that. UNLV usually plays late games, but, I mean, that excuse is quickly erased if you say, well, your best game of the season against Vanderbilt was also a day game. I mean, not as early in the day, but still a day game in an even farther time zone. So it's like, you know, there's no real explanation for why UNLV came out of the gate so slow against Colorado State.
Caleb, as players, what goes into developing consistency in terms of putting forward 60 minutes of your best effort? Because we've seen this UNLV team in its best stretches play football that is of the quality of the top programs in the Mountain West, but when it's not there, it's just simply not there. It's hard to see a team go back and forth between those two extremes.
Well, consistency, in my opinion, is born in repetition, and it's not just doing reps and half speed and you know, routes on air or anything like that. It's about constantly having pressure situations, constantly having best on best situations, constantly having, even within yourself, that intensity that I'm going to do this rep the best that I can with my full ability, with game speed in mind, with all these variables going through your mind, and just repping situations as much as possible. Becoming accustomed to in-game situations and in-game expectations from your coaching staff and from yourself. I mean, that's the only real way to get consistency, because you only get so many games to play. And if you don't prepare that way, if you don't put that sort of energy and effort into the way you practice or the way you play or even the way you watch film, that level of intensity has to start in the summertime. And even in spring ball, you have to treat those reps like game situations. Otherwise, you start to see those variables where when you're at your best, you're at your best. But you have those lows as well. Another part of it is the emotional disconnectedness, if that's such a thing, from the game. I think to a certain extent, every player should have this kind of off switch where you don't get too high with good things that happen to you, and you don't get too low with bad things or when things go wrong or things don't go quite your way during a game. You have to kind of stay even keel and keep that same level of consistent effort no matter what the situation is, no matter what the results of the play were. You have to attack each play like it's a new play, or each series like it's a new series, with that same intensity. So there's a lot that goes to it, and a lot of it is mental. Consistency, in my opinion, is all mental. You can have all the physical tools you want, but or be told all the right things, but it's a mental thing for a player, each individual player, to go out there and do what they know is right or perform at their best, at their peak, on each one of their reps, each one of their snaps.
I think that's what makes these last few games so interesting, Caleb, because we know the goal of 6 wins is gone, and as you said, that has some effect on Coach Sanchez potentially, but I know that's not the primary thing for anybody in the locker room. But now, how do you keep that mental sharpness and that mental focus in a situation where you know the bowl eligibility is gone and you do potentially have some things about the future of the program hanging over what's going on?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that, you know, if I'm sending a message to the players, they have a lot to be grateful for the position that they're in. I mean, they just got a brand new facility, one of the greatest facilities in the conference, if not the best practice facility that's theirs now, if they're going to be returning for future years at UNLV. It's their program, or it's their facility. And if you want to be, you know, judging this by the success of the program, they haven't earned that. And so there's some things you have to play to kind of get the respect that you earn something, that you're worth it, that your effort that you put in matches the effort that all of these outside sources have put into you, the investment they put into you to give you such a gift. And that to me is one of those things I would take personally as an individual. Like if I felt that somebody was investing something in me, I owe it to them to not go out and perform to those expectations, at least play my hardest for the remainder of the season. For seniors, there's a legacy. I think if this is your last stint as a Rebel, there's nothing greater than to leave on a good note or to have some sort of special fond memory to go out on. A bowl game would have been ideal for these guys, but there's the last game of the season is still Reno. And keeping the cannon red, that's something that gets enshrined in stone at UNLV. If you were part of the graduating class that kept the cannon red or turned the cannon red, you'll forever be remembered at UNLV for that. So there's that. Then there's just the pride of the deal. I mean, if you're at this level of competition, if you don't have pride in your performance on a week-to-week basis and you can go out there and be okay with losing or tanking or calling it a season and, you know, with 3 games left, that's a personal issue I think that you should have had weeded out long ago in your own competitive life. But really at this collegiate level, I think a coach would hope that there's none of those guys in the locker room that are willing to quit just because a bowl game is no longer a possibility. You still want to win each week. Every time you go out there, you want to compete and put your best performance out there. And I think that's something that every player at this level should have by default, is that I'm going to compete as hard as I can week in and week out.
He calls the games on radio, UNLV football games on radio. It's former quarterback Caleb Herring. Let's talk about some things that need to be fixed to potentially win 2 of 3 or all 3 down the stretch. And, you know, there's a reason they're 2-7 because of the inconsistency. Different things come up in each game that they lose. The last two games, it's been mystifying to see what's happened to special teams, because special teams were pretty solid through the beginning of the season, but they had a punt blocked against San Diego State for a touchdown. That was a backbreaker. And then at a kickoff return in this last game from the get-go, and then also the punt coverage in the last game, you know, they were allowing like 13, 14 yards per punt return. What has happened on special teams? Tony Sanchez explained it a little bit, that they lost two key contributors in Neal and Godfrey, especially in this last game against CSU, but is that enough to explain what's happened the last two games?
No, I don't think that in itself is enough. I think it definitely hurts. I think the depth of a team shows up in units like special teams, because the level of talent as you go, you know, we see it on defense, for instance. So we've known throughout the season that the one defense can hold their own, they can play good. And it's when you start to mix in the twos and threes into the rotation, and when the ones get tired and you start to see the twos get in there more, that's when you saw a lot of the lapses early in the season. Mm-hmm. Well, the special teams unit is made up of the twos and threes on the depth chart. And it's no knock on those guys. They're younger guys, most of them, and they just haven't done it as long. But on other programs, the 2 and 3 deep, they're really competitive for that number one job, where there's not such a drop-off from the number one to the two on the depth chart with a lot of these teams. So that's why special teams units are a little bit better. Now, that may be one of the reasons that UNLV's special teams units have struggled really all season. It's not as disastrous as it has been in the last two games, but really all season they've had issues with the punt coverage teams and giving up those hidden yards on punt coverage especially. And that kind of hurts the overall outcome of the game. Like, you look at the numbers for Colorado State game, yardage-wise in the first half, the Rebels are right there with them. But that goes to the hitting yards on punt coverage and punt return, where they're starting with great field position every time they have the ball. They're just not as far to travel to get to a touchdown. But I think that, for UNLV, is one of the problems. The depth as a whole, as a team, is kind of magnified when you go to the special teams unit, because that's a lot of the special teams units, like I said, are the backups that don't start on a defensive unit or an offensive unit, but they get their chance to play on these special teams units. You trust them as a coaching staff to put them out on the field. That's their playing time. That's, you know, the way they get onto the field and the way they showcase their talent. But also, I guess, in the Rebels instance, it kind of has been an Achilles heel where the special teams unit has had a drop because the depth issues. And special teams will go unnoticed in a game. And a coach is fine when the special teams unit goes unnoticed. But when they mess up, when there's mistakes in special teams, they are huge. They are probably of the – because you don't expect them as a coaching staff. You go into the game thinking no interceptions, no fumbles, you know, create interceptions, all this stuff. But it's never one of the things like don't get a punt block. That should never be something that you say in a team meeting. Like special teams should kind of just run itself.
Well, some of the controllable stuff, too, and I'm not sure if you just mentioned it here, but we should mention it again. You know, Jacob Gasser, the punt returner, catching a couple of balls inside the 10. I mean, those are little things, but, again, that's hidden yardage where you potentially – I think one of them was like a soccer-style kick, wasn't it, where it was bouncing forward. You know, all of a sudden you're starting off on, like, the 4-yard line when you could be at the 25.
Hey, that's situational awareness, game awareness, positional awareness. As a punt returner, you're initially thrown – this is when I, you know, when I played and kind of the school of thought I played under. If you're a punt returner – and you start off with your heels at 10, you're not backing up. If this punter is good enough, and the rare instance in a San Diego State guy where you know this guy's been dropping them on the 2-yard line and they got a really good coverage team and they've been good at it all season, then yeah, maybe I tell them back up. But usually if the guy's going to pin you inside the 10, there's nothing you're going to do as a punter to stop it. Like you said last week, a rugby-style kick, which is a line drive bullet coming right at you, there's no reason to be backpedaling to catch that at the 2-3-yard line. That ball is going to skid out of the end zone, and I think most people know that. It's a coachable moment. I mean, I understand that the coaches have a job to coach that up and not at all bashing the kid for making a decision. He made the catch. He caught the punt. Great. But those kind of things, like you said, the hidden yardage there, that's a 17-yard difference. Offensively, starting a drive on a 20-yard line versus starting on a 3-yard line, that is huge in controlling game situations, controlling field position, that type of thing, and just sticking to your overall game plan. That's a big-time thing. So those kind of things on special teams unit that I guess don't really show up as hurting you on the stat sheet necessarily, but if you're watching the game and paying attention, what you say, boy, they had to start on a 3-yard line and it was really an unforced error. It's not a great punt or anything like that. It's just a bad decision by one of the players, and that's what it was. And those kind of things hurt you in the end.
Let's talk Kenyon Oblad. How you would grade his performance? He has 12 touchdown passes now in the season in just 5 games, so he's actually top 6 in the country amongst freshman quarterbacks for touchdown passes. He made some big plays, but throughout the game, I don't know if it was a carryover from the San Diego State game or was something CSU was doing. He just seemed a little rattled, and he was inaccurate. A lot of high passes from Kenyon Oblad.
Yeah, a lot of high passes, and that was early in the game, and I don't know how much the size of the Colorado State defensive line or having a couple of passes batted down throughout his season have affected that, but again, when you have, usually as a quarterback, I can say when you have high passes like that, it's bad mechanics. And that comes from being sped up in the urgency and, like you said, being off the spot and rattled in the pocket. So you get bad technique. Your elbow drops and comes up. Your footwork is bad. You're off center a lot. And that's kind of what you see with the inaccuracy there. And a lot of the times people, you know, look to your arm immediately and just say, oh, this guy's not accurate. But the situation around you kind of dictates your accuracy. And I think, like you said, last week San Diego State got him off his mark. And this week Colorado State was not hesitant to blitz early and often. They blitzed, I think, 4 of the first 6 downs, they blitzed and brought pressures. And from the safety, they're bringing some speedsters coming down. He got sacked 3 times, if I'm not mistaken, in the first half, and hit several other times. So he definitely, the scouting report is out, just like it always is on young quarterbacks, to pressure them and get them off their mark. It's how he responds to it and handles it. And I think his overall grade, like you said, he finished with decent numbers, a couple of touchdown passes late after the game was, I think, pretty much decided. But his performance, I don't think he took a step forward because, like you said, the pressure still got to him, and it seems like there's some carryover. And I guess this team and more teams will start to see he can get rattled under pressure. So that's going to be something he has to show that he can handle. But I think he's going through every lump that a young quarterback should go through. And you hate to see it as trial by fire, but this is what you get when you have a young quarterback. They're going to get rattled every now and then. How does he handle it? How does he bounce back? And how does he get through adversity on the other side of it? That's going to be the key. But overall, Oblad, a solid performance. Nothing really negative or harmful to say about what he did last week.
Caleb Herring's with us. Is Armani Rodgers going to play the rest of the season?
The way things look, I doubt it. I don't see any reason for it to happen. I think either way, the program is now in future-oriented mode. And I think building for the future, the most valuable thing for the program, for first and foremost, for the program is to continue to groom Kenyon to be the guy taking over the keys to the program at this point in the season with, like I said, postseason hopes pretty much down the drain. The younger guy who has more upside and kind of still is a work in progress, so to speak, I think you get him as many reps as you can in the game, make his reps count while you're here. I mean, that's whether or not you know who the coach is going to be next year or if it's going to be Sanchez. I think that is the move. Whether it's because of Armani's health, I don't know how that situation is. How 100% he is. If he's not 100%, we've pretty much been kind of guessing game with that. He's been wearing a knee brace for the past few weeks, so not sure if that's the case. But like I said, Oblad seems to be the future of the program from the outside looking in. That seems to be where the decision's headed at this point. So there's no reason, in my opinion, as a program going forward, that you should see Armani in some sort of quarterback controversy at the end of the season right now.
Let's close on a positive, because I want to counter people out there who say that Tony Sanchez has done nothing for the program beyond getting the facility done. This team is in better shape than it was from a talent standpoint after the last two coaching regimes. And I'll point to the offense specifically. They've got a redshirt freshman quarterback who clearly can be a starter for the next couple of years, right? Randall Grimes, right. I know it may be lost in these losses. Randall Grimes is turning into a freaking monster. He's got to be a little more consistent, cut down on the drops. But he made a catch on Saturday that was just outrageous. And if he's going to be around moving forward, if Tylee Collins is going to be around, they've got a nice receiving core. Clearly, they've got some weapons developing. Sounds like Noah Bean's going to be okay and possibly can play against Hawaii. But there are some major building blocks on offense, and Grimes is the guy who has just been super impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Grimes, that catch last week was probably I put it in the top 15 catches that I've seen in the college season. But it was so quietly. It happened so quietly because of the situation in the game. But it was a phenomenal catch. And he's just a freak athlete. And to be his age and so young with so much upside in front of him is kind of ridiculous when you think about getting him to come to UNLV from where he came from and his physical potential. But Tony's done a lot for this program. I can speak from somebody who was a part of the program not too long ago, in 2013, just looking at the quality of size. I think the first thing that I noticed, like, in a difference, the offensive line is huge now compared to when I was there. Like, there are just not a lot of big guys at UNLV on the offensive line. They've had a top 25 rushing offense in the nation for 4 of the 5 years that he's been there. So he's done good things. You've had Lexington Thomas, one of the all-time leading rushers in UNLV history, Charles Williams, who now broke 2,000 yards as a Rebel. And so that is a positive. He's built a running game that is solid and sustainable. Like you said, the talent that he's brought in, Tylee Collins, who hasn't had a great year this year, but as a freshman, one of the top freshmen in the conference. And how do you develop that? How can you develop? He's still very young. There's still potential there. So those are some pieces that he's brought into the program through recruiting and is savvy with that aspect of head coaching. Translating to wins and losses, that hasn't happened. I mean, he's had 5 wins. A couple times, but it hasn't got to a bowl game, hasn't got over that hump. And then I don't understand how you can stay except for the Fertitta complex. I mean, that doesn't happen with anybody as the head coach other than Tony Sanchez. And I think anybody who says otherwise is tricking themselves into a lie. I think that is a major thing to be able to do with a program that hasn't had a winning record since 2013. So that's a huge thing to be able to pull off. And that is, I think, the biggest impact that he's had in future generations. Whether he's a coach next year or 10 years down the road, you'll look at that complex as one of the – if UNLV goes on to do great things with another coach, for instance, that recruiting tool, that facility, that developmental tool at the program will be a huge part in that success. So to ignore that and say, well, he hasn't done anything except, that's a pretty big except to throw in there. So if the decision is made to part ways with Tony Sanchez this offseason, I personally would appreciate what he's done for the program if that is the decision that takes place at the end of the season.
All right, Caleb, we appreciate it. We'll talk to you.
No problem, guys. Have a good one.
There you go, Caleb Herring, color voice on UNLV Radio, former quarterback of the Rebels. On the way back, we'll get to the best part of the Monday Night Football game, the black cat on the field.
Visit Cofield's Corner on LVSportsNetwork.com for access to the latest podcasts and best interviews.
He's walking to the three. He's at the two. And the cat is in the CDW red zone. CDW, people who get it now, a policeman, a state trooper is come on the field. And the cat runs into the end zone. That is a touchdown.
Now, back to Cofield and Company, live at the Thomas and Mack.
That was a boring game for a while. Boy, the cat came on the field. That changed everything. It was 9-3 at that point. I figured the cat was going to be bad luck for the Cowboys. As it turned out, it was just the kiss of death for the Giants. Giants got outscored, I think, from there 34-9.
Have you been watching the last 10 years of Giants football? You thought that was going to go against the Cowboys?
Wait. You have two Super Bowls.
Not in the last 10 years, I don't.
Well, also understand, my narrative was wrapped into the fact that I had bet the Cowboys. So I was like, this cat's going to kill my chances here. What the hell?
This isn't the Cubs, man. Like, this is the Giants. There was no hope. They were the Cubs when that happened, right, 40 years ago? They're in the midst of a playoff push. The Giants were always going to be terrible this year. You're looking too much into it. You're speaking with your money. That was your anxiety about the dollar bills.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping for a little reverse jinx. Yeah. Control the karma. Kevin Harlan's hilarious. That's at least the second time he's done that. I think there was like some drunk jackass on the field last year or 2 years ago, and he did the play-by-play of hunting him down and then hopefully getting his ass kicked on the field. You were not going to catch that cat. That was not going to happen.
No, actually, rumor is it's an actual stray cat that lives at the stadium.
Oh, it's not a rumor. Oh, there are reporters.
Oh, it's official.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a – who was the lady who reported it? Someone who was out at the game – said, checked with stadium officials. Madeline Burke asked building security about black cat on the field. Apparently, there are some resident stray cats at MetLife. They usually come out after the game. People feed them, etc. They live in the bleachers. I'm told this one must have gotten a little startled by the fan noise. And she said, hashtag journalism.
Someone's got to keep the rats under control out there.
It's a swamp. Everybody understands that, right?
Yeah.
This entire stadium complex is a swamp. East Rutherford is the definition of you are in a swamp.
Right.
It's pretty bad. I feel like Big Mac and I are laughing at this, and Candy's like just really annoyed about the whole Giants.
He can't get past the fact that his season's over.
Cat thing.
I'm actually a little bit upset at the cat.
I mean, are you?
Can we stop calling it the cat? Do we have a name for the cat?
Henry? I don't know. It's a cat.
I saw Mr. Cuddles. I like that. Can we call Mr. Cuddles?
No. Mr. Cuddles with that grill?
I saw
that. By the way, that was the best part. The camera work on the cat. They kept zooming in on the cat, and the cat had like that what was the pissed off hurricane cat in Houston? You ever see that picture? There was a cat swimming, and he's just like, mother. Like, just so annoyed. And this cat was like, why are there 75,000 people in my house?
This is my home.
I saw three different suggestions for the cat. You guys can vote on which name you actually like the best.
Okay.
I saw Jason Kitten. I saw Feline Manning. And I also saw Amari Cooper.
Wow, you did that well.
I hate the last one.
It was a little creepy.
And I don't know if it was the name or the way you did it, but yeah. I like Jason Kitten.
I would just go with something like Grumbles. Little Grumbles.
You're the one who gets to weigh in here. You're the one who has a small sanctuary going on at your home.
Yeah.
Do you even name your cats, or do you just call them by their color?
The feral cat is by the color. Yeah, well, we actually have multiple feral cats, but the feral cat that's really loyal to us, the chick that's outside.
The one that's truly loyal to us. You're making it sound like...
Well, there's others that come
like
and go.
Like it's the Gambino crime family. They need to prove their loyalty to us. Which ones come back?
No, he's right. I got one that shows up about every 2-3 months. It lives on the roofs, and like it'll come, and I'll give it water. It never... I can't get that thing within 3 feet of me. I try to like pet it and say hello. Has no interest.
You guys are blowing me away. The idea that you want these cats closer to you. I fake I'm throwing rocks to get them to leave.
You're horrible.
There's actually a whole catch program now where they're fixing cats, and then you can have a fixed colony, and they kind of protect the neighborhood
from
rats and the stupid pigeons.
Way cool with that. And actually, don't badmouth pigeons. That's where I was going next. Two years ago, I had a pigeon's nest by one of the columns of my house. I started talking to them every day. I love animals, man. Pigeons, cats, I don't care.
How'd they answer you? By taking a dump on your head?
No.
They're disgusting.
They are not.
Oh, God.
They have a bad reputation.
We have
me and Mike Tyson, man. We love the pigeons.
We have such a massive pigeon problem in my neighborhood, and we have a lady who's on that Nextdoor app, and she's – I don't know if she's trolling or she tries to, like, make the whole pigeon pitch, and we're like, lady, we're going to kill you. Like, it is illegal to feed those dirtbags. Get them out of the neighborhood.
What are you doing on that app? Why would you ever sign up for that?
I know. I get the alerts. I go every once in a while.
I've been getting the actual mails to my house for like 2-3 years. Hey, community sign up. Password only lasts 14 days. Have you not learned? I'm not signing up for your stupid app because I don't care what you're talking about. Just make sure my roof's not
He doesn't need to talk to people on next door. He's got a whole colony of pigeons living right outside his house.
Thank you,
that
Candy.
Are plenty of community for him.
He's got in person next door because he's got old man Bill in his neighborhood he's nearly brawled with. So you guys have face-to-face interaction because all the old people are not on next door.
It's true. I keep it real with the old folks.
On the way back, we're going to get an update on the Raiders Henderson facility and more griping about Thursday Night Football from John Gruden.
Join the conversation on Twitter at Cofield & Co. Now, back to Cofield & Company, live at the Thomas & Mack.
Game time, 7 o'clock. It's Purdue, Fort Wayne, in T.J. Altenberger's debut as the Running Rebel head coach. Lots of new players on the team. High hopes for this group. We'll hand it off to Running Rebel warm-up with John Sandler and Curtis Terry in for Robert Smith. 6:30, Candy, Cofield. McKinnell is down here. Do we allow McKinnell to go in on Joe Buck? I don't know. Where are you on Joe Buck,
Candy? I am wholeheartedly pro-Joe Buck.
Okay, so you're pro-Joe Buck. I kind of don't care. There are other guys who are. I'll tell you, our vast sound crew's got to pull some audio from the Raiders game. Tom Brenneman is unfreaking bearable, especially when you're watching a Raiders game and you got characters like Richie Incognito. Man, that guy is more than willing to get up on his pedestal and point down on the evil Raiders. And so I don't mind Joe Buck. You heard the Kevin Harlan catcall, and then all of a sudden you go, and by the way, he made a play-by-play call of a cat running on the field. He wasn't catcalling. That's a different term.
Yeah, I know.
I just want the audience to know.
Oh, okay.
Like they're like, what did we miss? Who did Kevin Harlan go after?
No, man. Like,
and you wanted to lay into Joe Buck. What's your problem?
I mean, do we not – if we don't have audio to bet – because I feel like a lot of people who love Joe Buck, I don't think they've really been shown the light. I think it's just, you know, 20 years of listening to
know.
Him. And he's
– And you guys hang on to the – and you know what? It was a bad moment.
No, it's
and
not.
Joe Buck's done millions of games. The faux outrage, the – in this case, St. Joe Buck reaction to Randy Moss on the fake moon, that was stupid. I'm sure he would tell you, yeah, I got a little worked up there.
David Tyree in the Super Bowl catches the ball on his helmet. Eli Manning escapes 3-2-3 tackles, goes out, lobs a ball. In the most incredible play in the history of the NFL, in my opinion. And he calls it like a warm cup of milk, like leftover mashed potatoes. There is zero emotion. Now, I understand there is difference between television and radio. Fully understand that. This guy brings nothing to the table. He's clean. He's professional. He knows what he's talking about, but in terms of passion, emotion, making calls that last forever, this guy has consistently ruined the biggest moments in sports by reacting to nothing. He has no reaction. Is Joe Buck even a sports fan, or does he just do it because he wants to make his dad happy? Answer me that, Candy. I really don't know.
You're a play-by-play guy.
That's your job.
Is Joe Buck picking his spots? As some play-by-play guys will tell you, hey, I don't get fired up all the time. I try to pick my spots. I guess to McKinnell's point, he missed the spot with Tyree.
All right, let's go one by one here. The David Tyree situation.
I
am a Giants fan, and so I get to probably have a little bit of an opinion here on whether he, quote, ruined one of the greatest moments in NFL history. He couldn't see it. Like, I'm going to be real honest about it as a play-by-play
guy. I have fans in front of him.
He couldn't.
The Goodyear blimp fly in front of the window?
Hey, Ari.
Hold on, real quick.
Ari, punch up the Commodore 64 and see if you can find the highlight before the end of the hour.
Fair enough.
David Tyree.
Okay. I'm not gonna go all you didn't play the game here, but but let me just say, with a dozen play-by-play years under my belt, there are times that you have a little bit of trouble figuring out what the hell just happened, and I think it cost Joe Buck in that moment because he didn't have a lot of emotion.
Did he miss Eli Manning escaping the three tackles?
He actually called that part of
it. No, he literally says, Eli Manning. We'll bring up the audio. He doesn't describe a thing, and then we pulled like six other plays where he's calling nothing, a 60-yard kick return where McMillan from the Eagles breaks like seven tackles. What? And he literally just repeats the words McMillan. It is god-awful. There is no emotion. There is no passion. There is no description. There is absolutely nothing.
What did this man do to your pigeons?
What this has nothing to do with pitches. This is my sports. I'm way more serious about my sports.
Show me where on the doll Joe Buck hurt you. I don't understand how it got this hard for you.
Right here in my heart.
Is it that bad?
Yes.
To your point about does he pick his moments, one of the things you have to know about TV play-by-play is when to lay out.
Sure.
And you have to be able to lay out and let the big moments breathe because the rest of your production crew, the dozens of other people who are putting that game out, are doing their job in that moment. And Joe Buck has talked about this, that he has learned how to stay back from some of those big moments and not say anything at all. And I agree with it.
I agree. There is something to be said for letting the crowd tell the story, right? To letting it marinate. He doesn't do that. The moment is happening, and he's saying words that don't make any... He's saying numbers and players. McMillan, Manning, you're not describing anything. And then when it happens, you get less passionate, you get less excited, you deadpan the moment. It's like counterintuitive to everything that I know as a sports fan. Here's a big moment. Now I'm just going to, some warm milk for you.
So what are the calls that you remember that are super passionate calls from other broadcasters?
Al Michaels, Miracle on Ice.
And so I love this. I'm so glad you went to Al Michaels.
Okay.
Because have you heard a call from Al Michaels in the last, in the last almost four decades? Have you heard anything where Al Michaels has matched that level of
Absolutely.
Emotion?
Antonio Freeman in the Green Bay Packers where he catches the ball off his leg on Monday Night Football.
Once he figured out what was going on in that moment,
yeah, it was
right?
an outstanding call.
Once he figured out what was going on in that moment, he picked up to it. He's called 40 years worth of games, and you're picking out two games where you think he did really
fantastic. You asked me
fantastic.
For another one, I gave you another one. If I knew what we were going to do this segment, I probably could have pulled some more.
Right, but you're picking two or three examples of Joe Buck having a hard time with it and
I literally YouTube Joe Buck's worst calls, and it was an 8-minute compilation of him doing nothing in some of the biggest moments in sports, from the World Series to the Super Bowl, playoffs, AFC Championship, NFC Championship, him not calling the action, just saying names. And one of the clips he started talking in the middle of a playoff game where Lance Briggs just sacked tackled the Seattle player for a tackle for a loss. He starts talking about inches and fractions and what's bigger, 5/8 or a half a yard. And I understand it's taken out of context, right? You can take anything and make anyone look like an idiot. This is a sample size of decades of him underselling the biggest moments in sports.
How about we take a timeout? We'll come back, eye on sports gaming, and we'll see if Ari can get the Commodore 64 running.
Continue the Cofield and Company conversation on Facebook. Friend us at ESPN Las Vegas. It's Cofield and Company's Eye on Sports Gambling.
I'm going to kill your bookmaker. I'm going to rip his throat out. I will step on his throat until the man chokes. Let me tell you how. Winners, 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 winners. Free, 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 free.
All right, let's hit a couple things on the gaming front. We'll get to some legitimate lines in a couple of minutes. I just want a prediction from you guys. I don't know if you've seen what's going on at USC in terms of the rumor mill. So they brought in the AD from Cincinnati, right? Urban Meyer went to Cincinnati. Obviously, Urban Meyer has lots of Ohio roots. Now there are rumors out there that the president at USC has told Mike Bone, however you say his name, that he can't hire Urban Meyer, can't consider him, and now there are further rumors that he may just bail on the job. The AD may just say, screw it. If I don't have control, then I'm out. I don't want to say this is so USC, but shouldn't you have that all lined up before you either offer him the job or he takes the job? If that's his number one candidate, if there's an objection, then you got to clear that before he gets a gig, right?
You're one of the marquee football programs, at least in terms of brand, in the country. And so if you view yourself that way, then that hire is the most important hire you're going to make. And if you are not going to give the person who is theoretically in charge of that hire control of it, why would that person want the job? If you are the USC athletic director and you can't hire the football coach, why would you want the job in the first place? You're not in control of anything if you can't make that hire.
Also, why would you not want Urban Meyer? Like, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, come on. There's a laundry list of why.
No, I hate Urban Meyer.
Why,
I can't
why you
stand
wouldn't
Urban
want
Meyer,
well, I think USC, as a fine institution of learning, feels like they're upper crust and they don't have to hire dudes like that who've got, 42 scrapes with the cops with their players, with his players at Florida, obviously producing a guy like Aaron Hernandez and then enabling him and recommending him to the NFL.
Ohio State didn't have a problem with it.
Correct. Ohio State's not USC. Now, Ohio State wins. That would be the argument. But Ohio State does not have any standards. Come on.
It's win
at all freaking cost at Ohio State.
I feel a similar way about USC.
Based on?
The history, Reggie Bush, everything. Pay to play, gifts, getting people there. I mean, they're not a clean program.
Reggie Bush.
Sure.
Okay, that's it.
And what we don't know. Come.
Ohio State backed up Jim Tressel with Urban Meyer.
Yeah, it's not a good look.
It's a terrible look.
I don't like USC.
Harvard enabled a complete scumbag woman abuser. How many times did he cover for the guy?
Yeah, I think they're both crooked programs.
Yeah, I'm not going to compare what SC's done over the years.
No. I would say Ohio State is worse.
Let's also frame Reggie Bush and what was done. That is done at every major program.
Yes.
The NCAA raked USC over the coals. I still feel like USC should have sued massively over that. Frankly, should have been so up in arms that the Pac-12 could have just bolted the NCAA. It's outrageous. The NCAA still forbids Reggie Bush to be part of official functions. Really? Really? Compared to what some other football programs do. But I get your point. Hey, you know what? USC can get down there in the mud, and maybe you have to get down there in the mud to win at the highest level. It was really interesting on Saturday on, I think it was the pregame show, Urban Meyer was on that Fox pregame show, and I heard him talking about a specific recruiting philosophy when he was at Ohio State. He would look at schools that were down in their regions, and that became a target.
Smart.
Yep.
And that's the other thing about him.
And the reason I bring it up is, what is Southern California for the rest of the country now? For Oregon, for Ohio State, for elite schools around the country, they're like, hey, UCLA and USC are down. We're going into Southern California, and we're taking their best players. Now, if you want – here's what's going to happen with Urban Meyer. If he goes to USC, you will win, and you potentially will win a national title. It'll probably flame out in 5 or 6 years. There's a chance you could be on probation. There's a great chance he will embarrass you. There's almost 100% chance that things will go south at some point, and he will fake an illness and walk away. But will he get you to a better level in those 6 years? Yes.
Exactly.
And Ohio State seems to have carried, you know, the momentum into Ryan Day with a great roster. I don't know if this guy can recruit. We'll see when he gets his own players. But right now, Urban Meyer left him pretty healthy because no one came down on him for the dirtbag assistant coach.
Yeah. I was just surprised to hear that USC allegedly, potentially, would be out of the Urban Meyer hunt, especially when our pal Sports by Brooks came on. You know, he's made reference to he is pretty positive that Urban Meyer should and will be the next coach of USC. It feels like with all that noise, just a little bit of a shock that they're coming out and saying no, we don't want Urban Meyer. I don't believe that.
We should bring up another factor. It's something we talked about with, say, Rick Pitino to UNLV, right? Do you think a female athletic director, Desiree Reed Francois, wants to be connected to a guy like Rick Pitino? Do you think that Carol Folt, a female president, wants to be attached to Urban Meyer based on him turning a blind eye to a terrible relationship, husband-wife, on his coaching staff?
But why would a guy want to be associated with it anymore, though? I guess I don't see where the gender alone makes it so that you wouldn't want to be associated with that person. If it's wrong, it's wrong, right? I don't think you take an extra L if you're a female person in that position who does it.
NBA last night, boy, they got me. The gritty, gutty, likable Golden State Warriors?
2001, baby. Let's go. Okay.
2001.
Maybe not.
Two Tuesdays ago before Steph Curry went down, you were pitching 100-1 NBA title bet. Then Curry went down.
Yeah.
I got what you were saying.
They opened at 12-1. They moved to 100-1. They still got Steph, you know.
They come out of the gates. They're getting their ass kicked.
Right.
All season. They're 1-5 ATS. Last night, I looked at the line. I'm like, all right, I think it's getting too aggressive now, even with the fact they have no players. Portland was laying 11.5-12, and Portland absolutely looked like they knew what the spread was, and they've seen the results from the Warriors. They did not show up. They were terrible. Now, of course, much of my analysis based on the fact that late in the game, I'm like, all right, Portland, of course, is going to win this one. It's fourth quarter. They're just going to turn it on. Yeah, I'll lay 3.5. And they barely whiffed it, barely even sniffed it. They got the game tied, and then I think it was like a 13-0 run. Eric Pascal, come on. 34 points? The crowd up there is MVP. I'm like, what is going on? But that said, I think this actually offers some value coming up. They're a bad team. So just because they can come up with a spirited effort every once in a while, Golden State is going to be terrible.
So wait, do you think that the books are going to turn a little bit on it and say, well, they're not as bad a fate as they would have been?
I'm not saying the books. I'm saying we're talking about the players here. that bettors could look at it and be, you know, a little hesitant. Maybe the number gets bumped down a little bit.
Okay, fair enough.
Did you check the timestamp on that? I'm wondering if the Black Cat had to do just for you and the Golden State game. You're the cat guy.
Yeah.
Check the time on that. Just check it out.
I got spoiled last night because I did take the Cowboys in the game. The Black Cat helped me, and then I went over the top. I knew I should have stayed away from the Warriors game, and they were playing the game of their lives. And the crowd was into it, that gentrified crowd. They've been leaving every game. They had a reason to stay around this time, and they stayed around to watch Eric Pascal and I don't know who else. Kai Bowman.
It's Team Willie Cauley-Stein.
It's ridiculous. It's crazy. They play Houston this week. That should be a good total.
That should be a fantastic total because Houston has completely stopped playing defense this year.
That could be, I don't know, what do? You have to do high 220s, right?
That and total?
I'm saying, then you'll probably still get all over. What do you go to, 240?
No, that total is easily in the 230s. And, okay. And I think that you're probably looking realistically at the game finishing probably up in 240, 250 territory.
Lakers tonight against Ryan McKinnell's Bulls, laying 7. What do we think of the Lakers so far?
The Lakers look pretty good after night one. I think Anthony Davis certainly looks like a guy who received his get-out-of-jail-free card. Not that New Orleans is a bad place to live. But, Anthony Davis looks real. LeBron's playing defense. Like, they don't even have Kuzma back yet. I wasn't a Lakers believer before the year, and I'm not sure I'm 100% sold on them, but I've been impressed.
Yeah, no, I was a believer before the season. I am still now. They'll be a top three team in the West. There's a lot to like about this team. I didn't buy the whole LeBron is breaking down. He doesn't play defense last year. LeBron is at the level and the skills of few that have ever come before him. So in terms of motivation and what we talk about load management, that's not really his thing. But in terms of effort, I think he does have effort management. And last year, at different points, I think he was playing a little bit with that. Now, he knows that he's been listening to a pretty much a full year, more time than he's ever had before because he went down, around Christmas last year. They seem motivated in ways they weren't before. And I think you're getting talking about this a couple months ago, not getting eyes on Anthony Davis, right? You don't know how good he is because, you see him play a couple games a year, but you don't get that game-to-game-to-game viewing on a player like that. Now that we are for the Showtime Lakers, and I think we're actually seeing a better version of Anthony Davis. I think the question will be, is a lot of the noise that has been surrounding Anthony Davis recently on his return trip to Chicago, is will he be a Laker next year? Because I'm salivating at the possibility of him landing with the Bulls. I don't think it's going to happen. I think he's just being a good guy, but man can dream, can't he?
Candy moves on to other duties. Good job, Adam Candy. McKinnell and I will carry it until around 6:30 when Running Rebel warm-up gets you ready for the UNLV game tonight. Big Five includes a grading of Indiana cities. Do they have some of the worst cities in the country? Is Fort Wayne a terrible city? And what do we all think of the London Chargers?
Join the conversation on Twitter at ESPN Las Vegas.